This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Virtual chains to hold us down. Our turn never comes around.
You know, who in the last few decades has hired ad agencies to promote climate disinformation? Who has published books and gone on talk shows to cast doubt about climate science? Who are the drivers? Who have used their power, position, and wealth to effectively run out the clock and block alternatives?
Yes, who are the wealthy wizards putting doubt in your mind at your expense? From the Institute for Policy Studies, Chuck Collins' new report, Fossil Fuel Philanthropy: How Taxpayer-Subsidized Charities Promote Climate Change Disinformation and Stall Urgent Action. Then another shocker, Dr. Joan Casey: Breathing Wildfire Smoke Increases Risk of Dementia by 18%. As record wildfire years pile up and the smoke spreads all around the Northern Hemisphere and in Australia, well, yes, climate change can drive you mad.
Algorithms rule today. Welcome to techno feudalism. Lord and serf, feudalism. Techno feudalism.
Problems selling fossil fuels? Pesky green critics moving the public? Don't worry. In America, billionaires can hide money in charities, sowing doubt and denial. And taxpayers help pay billions of dollars for it, whether they know it or not. A new report from the Institute for Policy Studies digs deep and names names. The authors are Helen Flannery and Chuck Collins. Chuck is the director of the program on inequality and the common good at IPS. His most recent nonfiction book is The Wealth Hoarders: How Billionaires Pay Millions to Hide Trillions. In September, the pair released a detailed document. It's very helpful. It's called Fossil Fuel Philanthropy: How Taxpayer-Subsidized Charities Promote Climate Change Disinformation and Stall Urgent Action. Chuck Collins, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Great to be with you, Alex. Thanks for having me.
You know, it's not enough to become a multi-billionaire these days. You must protect your loot and grab even more. Chuck, tell us about the wealth defense industry.
There's a whole, like, sector, if you will, of workers whose job is to help the ultra-wealthy defend their assets, minimize tax, and maximize the amount of money that goes to heirs and children down the dynastic line. And we call that the wealth defense industry. They're tax attorneys, wealth managers, people who staff family offices. And again, Alex, these are people who they're serving, you know, people with $30 million, $40 million, or all the way up to the billionaires. So we're talking about super wealthy folks who can afford to hire helpers to help them move their wealth to the shadows.
So could you introduce us to the vast pools of money from fossil fuel profits to alleged charities pumping out climate denial?
Yeah, I mean, I think we're familiar that obviously the fossil fuel industry uses their influence and power to lobby and get fossil fuel subsidies and block legislation they don't like. But what we don't realize is that there are companies and individuals whose wealth has come from the fossil fuel industry who give to charity institutions. They give to their own foundations and donor-advised funds, and in turn, they fund think tanks and nonprofit groups that are doing climate disinformation, climate denial, promoting sham science. You know, I think we're all familiar with the Koch brothers, who Charles and the late David Koch, who used their considerable wealth coming from a oil services company, Koch Industries, to give a lot of money to candidates and politicians, but they also give a lot of money through the charity system, and they give it to the Heritage Foundation or the Cato Institute or the Heartland Institute, which is, you know, totally devoted to promoting sort of an alternative narrative on climate and energy. And our report found over a three-year period, 2020 to 2023, an estimated up to $5.9 billion in charitable gifts. These are gifts that the donors get a tax break. They get a tax reduction. We could identify, you know, a specific couple hundred climate denial groups that got received charitable donations. And our point here is the rest of us, taxpayers, essentially subsidize the charitable giving by these fossil fuel barons who are getting tax breaks and advancing their agenda. And I think the public hadn't really thought about that, and we hadn't really thought about it till a couple of years ago.
And you write, quote, "The fossil fuel industry has been able to harness our charitable system for their disinformation campaigns and to do it largely in secret. How do they protect these secrets, Chuck?"
Yeah, one of the ways is there's a sort of giving vehicle called the Donor Advised Fund. It's sort of like a mini foundation. You know, many individuals and donors have them. They might be at a sponsor like Fidelity or Schwab or Goldman Sachs. So they give money to this Donor Advised Fund, and as a donor, they direct where it goes, what's the nonprofit recipient. Well, it turns out Donor Advised Funds don't really have to disclose publicly where their donations are going. Foundations, private foundations, do have to disclose where their money's going. So what happens is wealthy fossil fuel barons have a family foundation. They will then give the money to a DAF, say at Schwab Charitable, and Schwab will then give the money to a climate disinformation group or a sort of a dark money organization. But the rest of us won't know that. So it's a way that they can kind of secretly move a lot of money to kind of more edgy and potentially negative publicity type organizations. We know, for instance, the Heritage Foundation, which published this book, Project 2025, which is sort of the blueprint for an incoming conservative Trump administration. A lot of that money that went to fund that research and that policy development came through donor advised funds, through anonymous donations, where donors didn't want anyone to know where the money was coming from. So it's a kind of a way to launder, if you will, or secretly move money to more partisan and edgy causes.
Growing up, we thought of charities helping the poor. Money was collected for food or blankets or something. Here we have charities supporting the rich. How is any of this propaganda and lying about science a charity?
Well, that's a great question, Alex. And you know, stepping back, I think part of the context is as wealth inequality has grown, as more and more of the societal wealth is concentrated in fewer hands, the whole philanthropy sector has somewhat been upended. We call it top-heavy philanthropy. Most of the giving is by very, very wealthy donors. And the share of giving by middle-income and non-wealthy donors keeps shrinking. Now you have very, very wealthy people, and they like to give through, they don't give directly to their nonprofits. Often they give through a foundation or a donor advised fund. They give through an intermediary. But, you know, that is a good question, and that's actually more of a question for, like, the Treasury Department and the IRS that give charity status to the nonprofit organizations. And they kind of walk a tight line there. The organizations, they may say, well, we don't really do a lot of advocacy. We're just doing policy development. We're providing public information and education. So they qualify as sort of education organizations. But the reality is they aggressively are putting out a point of view. I think most of us don't understand how that's possible. How is it that charity dollars go to something that has such a political, if you will, kind of program? But that is the case. If it was overtly political, if it was hiring a lobbyist to go to lobby a member of Congress, that may not fall into the tax-exempt purposes. But there's other ways that the fossil fuel barons and the wealthy use to move money in that way. So if you're the Koch brothers, you kind of sit there and say, what are all the tools that we have to influence and advance our agenda, our climate disinformation denial agenda? And so some of that would be, oh, okay, we'll give money directly to candidates. We'll give money to political action committees. We'll give money to C4 corporations that can do advocacy. And then we'll give some of these charitable dollars to think tanks and kind of education organizations that qualify as charities. So So they look at how to weaponize all the tools that they have in their toolbox, including their charitable giving.
As of December 2nd, 2024, Charles Koch's wealth increased by $6.75 billion this year. He's worth $67 billion, most of it from fossil fuel industry. If Charles spends $1 or $2 billion to keep the United States fossil-friendly to the max, is that just a cost of doing business?
Not just a cost of doing business. It's probably a rather smart investment for his own personal wealth. Since Election Day, we have seen, in anticipation of a fossil fuel-friendly agenda, we've seen oil and gas stocks go up, and we've seen people who are engaged in this, in that field, see their personal wealth rapidly increase. We're actually going to do a report in a couple weeks that looks at the big donors, the big conservative fossil fuel donors like Harold Hamm and Tim Mellon. These are billionaires who gave substantial money to elect the president-elect Trump and have seen their assets go up dramatically. In fact, on April 11th last year, Trump convened all the fossil fuel CEOs and the American Petroleum Institute. All these people came to Mar-a-Lago ostensibly to have a discussion about energy policy. But Trump made a bald-faced pitch. He said, basically, according to the people who were there, look, if you raise me $1 billion, I'll deregulate the energy economy and I'll get rid of those pesky rules, a moratorium on liquefied natural gas, all those kind of things. Oh, and by the way, you'll make, between the tax breaks and the deregulation, you'll make those donations back fast. Literally, he said, you'll get your money back really quickly. And that's already happening. The payback is already happening. From a very cynical point of view, giving money to charity, giving, a couple billion dollars to influence the political system and essentially capture the political system so that it's friendly to oil, gas, and coal is a good investment with a big return.
And you find just three of these heavily cloaked donor-advised fund sponsors provide two-thirds of the hidden funding for climate disinformation groups. They forwarded over $500 million that you were able to find into disinfo in 3 years. Could you tell us, who are they?
The three big ones, there's an institution called Donors Trust, which is kind of what Mother Jones calls it, sort of the dark money ATM of the conservative movement. It is a sponsoring organization for donor advice funds, and we know billions of dollars flows through that. The National Philanthropic Trust, which actually is the second largest recipient of charity dollars in the U.S., they funneled an estimated $242 million to climate disinformation organizations. And Schwab, through the Schwab Charitable Fund, is a huge intermediary of dark money and money that goes to climate disinformation, another $212 million. And that's the money we know about. We there are limits to how much we're able to track because of the secrecy of where DAF donations go. We can kind of overall track the recipient groups to some extent and look at where they're getting their money. Again, these are intermediaries that, some people have an account at Schwab and a donor advised account, and they give to, the food bank and the Boys and Girls Club. So it's not all that money is tainted, but people are very happy to use those donor advised funds as a way to sort of funnel money into the shadows to do this advocacy agenda.
America is really kind of a family system at the top of multi-billionaire families, and some of them have, like the Mellons, received it from their fathers and their fathers before them. So we have 10 private foundations named for their founding families, like the Scaifes, and they gave more millions to professional climate deniers. And apparently, it only takes a few dozen super wealthy individuals or families to plant climate doubt in millions of minds. That's what I'm seeing.
Yeah, I think, Alex, that's right, that what we've learned is that these wealthy fossil fuel barons, people who are heirs, I would call them dynasties, their family dynasty. The Mellon family from Tim Mellon is the fourth generation from the oil and banking family that worked with Carnegie and Rockefeller here's Tim Mellon. Four generations later, he's still a billionaire, and he's still giving substantial money to advance climate change denial agenda. And you look, yeah, the Scaife Foundation, the Kochs, the Popes, the John William Pope Foundation, the 10 big, these are family foundations. Many of them are kind of like from dynastically wealthy families, and they're still giving to organizations that are blocking alternatives, opposing solar and clean energy transition, sowing doubt. And I think what you said, Alex, is true. You know, what the fossil fuel industry figured out is if they can divide public opinion, if they can make environmental issues sort of culture war, right versus left, which wasn't always the case, you know, wasn't even the case 20 years ago, if they could drive that wedge and just stop reforms from happening. And that's a lot of what the fossil fuel industry has done in the way that they've captured our political system. So I kind of resent this because I feel like, well, these folks are using their considerable charity money, their taxpayers subsidized by the rest of us, charity giving, to run out the clock for action. And they're doing it quite consciously, and they're using a taxpayer-subsidized system to do it. So that sort of doubles the insult, if you will. But yeah, among these 10 foundations, you know, again, some of them are giving 34, you know, the Scaife foundations. It's $34 million over just 3 years to climate disinformation nonprofit. So it's a major centerpiece of their charitable giving.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex with our guest Chuck Collins from the Institute for Policy Studies in Washington, D.C. This river of dirty fossil fuel money must deliver perks to these public experts that we see on our television screens or in front of a Congress appearance. And they give the media quotes of doubt. They stoke paranoia in the masses. Oh, we're all going to freeze in the dark. You won't be able to cook meat anymore. And the spokespeople, they get excellent rooms in good hotels. They get conferences with applause. They get heavenly bar bills, no doubt, and all the appearances of power. And most of them are white men. Have you met these charity men? Have you talked with them?
You know, I have met a couple of them. You realize that, just as you describe, they are well-paid and well-taken care of by the fossil fuel industry. And essentially they are sort of foot soldiers in this partisan conflict over the future of energy policy. And their job is just to kind of stall and keep government away and keep public opinion from pushing government to take action to transition us to a post-fossil fuel economy. So, you know, I have met Kevin Roberts, the president of the Heritage Foundation. I have met James Taylor, who's the president of the Heartland Institute. I attended a Heartland Institute conference just to sort of see how they operated. Incidentally, his brother, who used to be a climate denier, has switched sides and is now a business leader who advocates for addressing climate change, the realities and harms of climate change. So here, within the same family, you have two people active on opposing sides. There's a woman, Michelle Bloodsworth, who is a big advocate for coal, and I've actually met and talked to her. And, you know, her job is to, in the next year, have existing coal plants considered critical infrastructure, classified as critical infrastructure, so they don't have to close down. And even everybody else in the field acknowledges coal is the worst, dirtiest form of carbon emissions, and so they're kind of just trying to take the money and run just for a few more years, keep those coal plants online. So here they're actively lobbying to keep coal plants open and get Trump to declare it's a national emergency and we should not shut those plants down so they can pollute just a couple more years and under the guise of energy independence for the U.S. Many of them are true believers. They really do believe that fossil fuel is, you know, the best thing ever, and to limit our uses of fossil fuel will harm the economy. But some of them are pretty cynical. They know the harms that they're sowing, and their job is just to keep the band playing for a few more years so they can extract more profits before the world shuts down their, you know, harmful enterprises. So that's the game that's underway, and here they are using charitable tax dollars to accomplish this goal.
Well, meanwhile, we have scientists on this program telling us we don't have those few years. In fact, we had those few years back around 2005 or something like that, but now it's too late. We can't be spending time doing nothing. Could you tell us about climatecriminals.org?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's, you know, what you just described is sort of our, there's a project called the Climate Accountability Research Project that we partnered with to do this report. And they've put out a website, climatecriminals.org. And, you know, we know now from research from groups like Inside Climate News and others that, you know, Shell and Exxon have known for almost 50 years about the harms of climate change. But what this project is doing is looking at the individuals, the decision makers, the people who had agency and power over those decision makings. You know, who in the last few decades has hired ad agencies to promote climate disinformation? Who has published books and gone on talk shows to cast doubt about climate science? Who are the drivers? Who have used their power, position, and wealth to effectively run out the clock and block alternatives? And so in July, on Climate Emergency Day this year, which is the day when the climate clock keeps ticking down, we released the 24 climate criminals. And I encourage your listeners to check out the website, climatecriminals.org, and learn their names and learn the people. And I kind of think someday, maybe not too far off, there will be global tribunals where we ask ourselves, who was responsible? Who ran out humanity's clock? Who cynically used their power to shut down alternatives? Just like war criminals, we will be bringing these individuals forward to face the consequences of their actions. And so we're preparing the dossiers and preparing the information. Yesterday, the first major climate-related case went before the International Criminal Court in The Hague in the Netherlands. We are encouraging them to look into individuals who have used their considerable clout to lead us down the wrong path. And I agree that it's not that the clock is ticking. We're currently passing points of no return. You know, we're going to continue to have extreme weather events and hurricanes and wildfires and floods. And, you know, I'm somebody who does some part-time farming and maple sugaring, and I can just tell you in 10 years, things are way more haywire in our ecology. You know, at this point, we got to turn the corner rapidly to diminish even worse consequences. So, yeah, the climatecriminals.org is really an effort to hold individuals responsible, as well as identify people who did the wrong thing and changed their minds and are now rejoining the rest of humanity in our effort to shift the trajectory of where we're going. So we think, you know, individuals are responsible, and they also can atone for the role that they played decades ago or recently. So we're calling on people to name the climate criminals. If they show up in your town, go out and protest them and turn your back on them. If they try to give to your local charity and greenwash and virtue wash their reputations, we can say, look, you're a climate criminal, and the current administration is appointing climate criminals in the administration. We should be calling them that. That's the role they play, just like war criminals in previous chapters of world history.
Yeah, the climate criminals appear to be taking over in America, at least for now. The proposed new head of the FBI promises to investigate critics, including journalists. You and I are midgets trying to pull back the curtain on the money wizards. Are we going to be in trouble?
I wouldn't be surprised, because if you think about where we're at, the fossil fuel industry knows that they don't have a lot of... they don't have much to stand on, but they are good at getting power, and they now have an incoming administration who not only is going to allow them to operate without oversight and regulation, but will also go after their opponents. So yeah, you know, maybe this conversation someday we'll have to, you know, but I'm willing to stand by what I'm saying here, and that's what happens when you have a fossil fuel authoritarian society. You know, there are other countries like Saudi Arabia where I suppose if you and I were criticizing the oil industry, we'd probably be in jail. Maybe the United States is heading that way, as scary as that sounds. That's when a fossil fuel industry cannot morally stand on its own. It has to use repression to keep its opponents down, and even to not have certain kinds of conversation in public spaces. That's unfortunately, you know, we're kind of veering into uncharted territory here as a democracy. Not in our lifetime have we seen anything that's been proposed like this. But I also think a lot of us are going to organize and try to promote common sense and ride out this moment that we're in. But it's just sad that we're going to spend another couple years not addressing the urgent scientifically based challenges that we're facing, and that we're going to be further distracted by the chaos and potentially the repression. So yeah, let's all stand up together here and keep telling people what we know.
From the Institute for Policy Studies, we've been speaking with Chuck Collins, director of the program on inequality and the common good. Our topic is fossil fuel philanthropy, how taxpayer-subsidized charities promote climate change, disinformation, and stall urgent climate action. And this free report's a real education on the people behind the veil. I encourage you to find it and read it. You can look for it at ips-dc.org, ips-dc.org, or use links in my show blog, published Wednesdays at ecoshock.org. Either way, Chuck, thank you for talking with our listeners here on the program.
Thanks, Alex, and thanks to all your listeners who care about this.
I'm Alex Smith reporting. This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. There is a ton of breaking news about climate change. Two stories I'm working on for you: global drying and the cause of the heat jump in 2023 and 24. The United Nations just released a report finding three-quarters of Earth's land became permanently drier in the last three decades. What? What happened to global wetting, the Earth getting greener, and 1,000 videos on TV and social media as flash floods roar through city streets around the world? Don't be fooled, the UN says. Yes, very extreme rainfall events are increasing, but most of the world's people, plants, and animals are facing a permanent drying. That means extinctions, reduced crop yields, flood strain leading to political stress, and more mass migration. We will explore. Second big news, pretty convincing science shows low cloud cover has decreased on this planet recently. That means less solar energy is being reflected back into space. That is probably why the Earth became warmer, faster, in the last 2 years, scientists say. It is more than ship emissions. This change, too, may be permanent. If so, global temperature will not go back down to 1.5 degrees C. The big warming was not temporary. Right now is the coolest time you will ever live through. And there is a ton we do not know about where this goes from here. The most extreme case is covered in my 2019 program, When Clouds Cannot Continue, The Great Warming. We are not there yet. All this and more coming up on Radio EcoShock. Next, now you need to protect your brain from wildfire smoke. Stay tuned.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
In the heart of the forest, flames dance with rage. A symphony of destruction on this burning stage. The trees weep embers, the sky turns to ash. As the world ignites, we watch it all crash.
Nobody likes breathing wildfire smoke, and you don't need to be near the woods. Now, with extreme conditions during climate change, smoke travels around the Northern Hemisphere, and lots in Australia, too. New research shows repeated exposure to wildfire smoke increases the odds of a dementia diagnosis by 18%. It is many times worse than smog particles from cars and industry. Protect your brain. Let's find out more from a co-author of a new study, Wildfire Smoke Exposure and Incident Dementia in Southern California, 2008 to 2019. Dr. Joan Casey is an environmental epidemiologist and associate professor at the University of Washington. From the West Coast, Joan Casey, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thanks for having me.
According to CAL FIRE, the 2024 wildfires in California burned more acres than in the previous 2 years combined, a terrible year. So Californians are getting smacked hard with smoke. But how can breathing wildfire smoke lead to dementia?
Gases and also particles, and the most important, PM2.5. And when those get deep into the lungs, they can actually pass into the bloodstream. And then throughout the body, they cause problems like inflammation, oxidative stress. They can damage your DNA. And downstream, that can lead to health problems, including eventually dementia.
And what is dementia, just in case somebody missed it?
Sure. So dementia is this umbrella term for a set of neurological conditions. So people are probably familiar with things like Alzheimer's disease, and that's one type of dementia. There are other types, things like frontotemporal dementia or vascular dementia. And each of these kinds of dementia, the thing that kind of links them together is they result in loss of cognitive function and people having trouble living their daily lives. And the thing that I think about that's such a big problem with these conditions is, one, they're extremely disruptive and really reduce quality of life. And two, we don't have great treatments for dementia. And so working hard to understand risk factors and what we can do to prevent dementia from occurring in the first place is really important.
Well, maybe increasing dementia is from smoking tobacco or even repeated COVID infections. How can public health specialists be sure wildfire smoke is involved in a brain condition that shows up years later?
We can't be sure. This is kind of the first major study, but we are looking at 1.2 million people age 60 and older. And because wildfire smoke is a little bit different from some other exposures, it's kind of random the way it occurs. People aren't really selecting where they live based on wildfire smoke, and it's hard to predict where wildfire smoke will hit next. And so it's completely true that many factors lead to people developing dementia, including genetic risk factors. But given the size of this study and the strength of the relationships we're seeing here and the biologic plausibility, I think, you know, we may be on to an important risk factor for dementia.
And the numbers don't lie. I mean, you've ran through a bunch of things and here came up with some results that seem to show a connection, don't they?
That's what we think. And we are controlling for some of those other factors that might put people at elevated risk of dementia, their backgrounds, the type of neighborhood they live in. And we're really trying to isolate the impact of their long-term exposure to wildfire smoke. But of course, as always, it won't be a perfect study. But what we do see here is over a three-year period, because we're interested in looking at kind of this cumulative, repetitive exposure to wildfire smoke that more and more people are now experiencing, that over a three-year period, a 1 microgram per meter cubed increase in average wildfire PM2.5 exposure resulted in an 18% increase in the odds of developing dementia, which is a fairly substantial increase in odds. And when we compare that to what we see for PM2.5 from other sources, things like industrial activity or traffic, we only see a 1% increase in the odds of developing dementia. So we do see, one, an overall relationship for both types of fine particulate matter, but two, a much stronger relationship with wildfire PM2.5.
As with vehicle exhaust, the health threat comes from tiny particles we cannot see. They are about 30 times smaller than the diameter of a human hair. Why are these invisible aerosols so dangerous for humans?
We're learning more and more about that as time goes on. It's interesting because every year that passes, I think we see more disease conditions linked to the quality of our air, and we're increasingly realizing how critical it is in the way that we've done a really good job of cleaning up drinking water in the U.S. by and large. We're now more and more realizing the air that we breathe, because we breathe all day long every day while we're awake and asleep, is super important. And so when you're inhaling these particles, they're causing all sorts of downstream effects in the body that can lead to health problems. And the thing that's unique or interesting about wildfire PM2.5 is it has a higher proportion of it is made up of ultrafine particles, which are 25 times smaller than PM2.5 itself. And so those teeny tiny particles can actually move directly from the nose into the brain, potentially damaging cells there that could lead to dementia or other neurological conditions.
Yeah, when I lived in Los Angeles in the early 1970s, the famous hills often disappeared behind a brown smog, and then came clean air regulations and cleaner air. Is it fair to say now wildfire smog has become the bigger threat in California, even for city dwellers?
Oh, absolutely. On days where it's polluted in California, on average, about 70% of that pollution is from wildfire smoke. So on days where it's really bad out, it's usually wildfire smoke that's the culprit. And we've seen on the west coast of the United States, after the Clean Air Act passed in 1970, we had huge improvements in air quality. And year after year, we would see improvements. And in the last decade or so, those trends have fully reversed in the western U.S., where air quality is actually getting worse now on average for PM2.5. And that's fully driven by increases in wildfire smoke exposure.
Joan Casey, what is in wildfire smoke that makes it so toxic to us?
Wildfire smoke is this heterogeneous substance, so it has gases and particles. In our study, we're focusing in on those PM2.5 particles, but other things are in there. So we have volatile organic compounds, VOCs, polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons, PAHs. We also have nitrogen oxides, which we know in the presence of sunlight react and create ozone, which is also helpful. I suspect that a bit of what we're picking up on here in our overall relationship with wildfire PM2.5 is driven by the other components of wildfire smoke that co-occur.
Well, we do have protective filters built into our bodies called the blood-brain barrier. Can these PM2.5 particles from fire smoke get past that directly into our brains?
We think not. We think the blood-brain barrier does a pretty good job with that. But these ultrafine particles may be able to slip through and cause direct damage to brain cells. And so it's kind of a subpart of PM2.5, the even tinier particles that are within that may be an additional problem. But the other thing I would say is we don't actually know that it's the particles directly impacting the brain itself that's the problem. We know that for many types of dementia, cardiovascular diseases are precursors to dementia development. And so it might actually be a different pathway through worsening cardiovascular disease in people tied to wildfire smoke exposure that down the road increases their risk of developing dementia. So my guess is it's several pathways, as it is usually the answer, that are at play here.
Your study looked at smoke and dementia. What about other neurodegenerative diseases like Parkinson's?
You're asking the question that the first author on this study, Dr. Holly Elser, who is a neurologist, has been poking at me. She is super interested in looking at that question because that is her hypothesis. We probably would see a similar relationship with other neurological conditions. We didn't look at that here, and to my knowledge, no one has looked at other conditions like Parkinson's in relationship to long-term wildfire smoke exposure. But it's likely some of these pathways are similar, and so definitely would be a good next step.
Well, suppose I'm vacationing at Disneyland in Southern California, and with bad luck, that week is filled with heavy wildfire smoke. Is a single exposure enough to make dementia more likely later on in life? Do we know the minimum dose for a wild smoke to trigger brain damage?
Short answer is we definitely don't know the answer to that question yet. The other thing I'd bring up is in our study, we're only looking at older adults. So we're looking at people 60 and older. So whether or not these findings translate to an earlier period in the life course, I think is an open question. What I can say is in this study, we looked at this three-year average exposure to remain exposure of interest. So living your life for three full years, what's the average amount of wildfire PM 2.5 you're experiencing? But we also looked at some other metrics because you're spot on. The way people are exposed to wildfire smoke is not really over this three-year period. The dosing comes usually in bursts where there'll be a few days or a week with really high levels of wildfire PM 2.5. And so we did, in this work, also try to use some metrics that captured those peak exposures. So we looked at the relationship between smoke waves and people developing dementia, smoke waves being two or more days where wildfire PM 2.5 exceeded 15 micrograms per meter cubed, so quite high levels. And we also looked at the peak exposure during the worst week during that three-year period. With those metrics, we did see, again, increases in the odds of developing dementia. And when we looked overall at kind of the total number of days where there was any wildfire smoke, so kind of capturing low-level exposure, we didn't really see a relationship there. So this kind of indicates that it might be those peak exposures that matter a lot. But back to your Disneyland trip, I would say it's a balance because the causes of dementia are multi-pronged, and things like spending time with family, social interaction is very important for preventing dementia. So it's always a balance. It's not an obvious answer. I would certainly say if you have a KN95 or N95, the face masks that folks were wearing during the height of the COVID pandemic laying around, I would recommend wearing one of those on your Disneyland trip. That would help. That can really filter out a lot of those particles that you'd otherwise be breathing in.
And this study determines that dementia from wildfire smoke increases for people over 75 years of age. Should the elderly mask up more or take protective cover, or does that matter if it takes decades of exposure to add dementia risk?
I think anyone 60 and older should take days that are smoky seriously from this study. And what I would say is folks can check the air quality index where they're living and try to understand if it's a bad air quality day. In the way that we now wake up and we check the weather on our smartphone, it'd be great if we got used to waking up and looking at the air quality outside and making some decisions based on that. You know, I need a raincoat and maybe I need a face mask. That's what I would recommend. If you're using the air quality index, the magic number is 101, where you might want to make some behavior changes. And what that looks like is staying indoors, closing the windows, if you have an air filter, running that air filtration system. If you do need to go outside, reducing activity, you don't want to do strenuous exercise, and then also wearing a mask. And that would be either a KN95 or a well-fit N95 mask that can prevent a lot of those particles from getting into your lungs.
That's what we do here, for sure. Now, do you know if your study would apply to people exposed to indoor smoke, like in traditional Indian cooking, or to Africans enduring smoke from burning crops and grasslands? Is it just in the wood?
Short answer is I don't know about indoor smoke. We definitely didn't look at that here, and that also indoor air pollution is a very important contributor to people's overall air pollution exposure. So that is an area where we need future research. in terms of what's burning, so our study included wildfires burning a variety of things. So many of these wildfires in California are in forests, but some of the fires in our study were burning within Los Angeles County in more grassy areas or even burning buildings. And so I think for the latter question, yeah, I would expect increased risk no matter the type of outdoor wildfire that's burning. We know that prescribed burns, which are those burns that we set to try to prevent wildfires from actually happening, also emit very similar smoke to wildfires themselves, but usually at a lower level that's better contained and in the end can have some health benefits.
COVID-19 is known to increase the risk of dementia. You and your colleagues ended this study at 2019, so you avoid that compounding problem. But do you think COVID might make further study of wildfire smoke and dementia more difficult to see?
That's a tough question. I don't think it will make it more difficult. I think it'll make the way we approach the question different. And you're right, we did cut off this study at the end of 2019 to kind of save ourselves the analytic challenges of looking at 2020 and 2021. And those challenges are many. So we're using electronic health record data here. This is a secondary data source, meaning we're looking at folks' health records that are primarily kept to support them in their clinical healthcare, seeing physicians and nurses in a healthcare setting. And then we're coming in as researchers and repurposing that data to study a different question entirely. And so we know there are major changes in care seeking during the COVID-19 pandemic, at least in the United States, where people were seeing clinicians less frequently, and probably dementia diagnoses were delayed in that case. And so we'd have to think about what that means when studying the COVID period. It's also true that it's likely that people who had multiple COVID infections may have increased risk to wildfire smoke exposure. We've seen in California that wildfire smoke exposure increased the risk of dying from COVID-19. And so I think there's kind of some different pathways here that we'll have to think about carefully. We're currently extending this cohort through the end of 2023. And so we will be working on this very soon.
This is a climate emergency. Find out more on the blog. Ecoshock.org. No sign up, just the latest info, free for all. Ecoshock.org.
Well, Joan, let's take an excursion into one of your earlier papers. I know listeners are concerned about the grid going down during extreme weather events. For example, a 2023 study found an extended blackout during a heat wave in Phoenix, Arizona, that about half the population, 800,000 people, would need emergency medical care. And of course, that's impossible. And you worked on a 2023 paper called Spatiotemporal Distribution of Power Outages with Climate Events and Social Vulnerability in the USA. Did you find a connection between climate-driven extremes and power outages?
Yeah, and this has been well documented by others, not just us, but in the United States, 60 to 80% of power outages are co-occurring with extreme weather events. And that's exactly what we saw here. We were working with this nationwide county level, so at the sub-state level, hourly power outage data set. And we basically were able to link a whole range of weather types to these outage events and see whether they were more likely to co-occur with one another. And so when we were looking at these different weather events like extreme precipitation or heavy snow or wildfires in the case of California, we absolutely saw these increased chances of there being a power outage. And that's pretty intuitive. I think people get that, but now it's well documented in the literature. And we're actually going on to zoom in on this a little bit more and see which weather types are the riskiest, and look by state in the United States and try to understand some of those questions.
And why is a power blackout of 8 hours or more considered a medical emergency?
So this is our working definition of a health-relevant power outage. we don't see from other scientists really a solid definition of this. And here's our thinking. If a power outage lasts 8 or more hours, it may move from being an inconvenience into a more life-threatening or at least health-threatening event. And that's particularly true for people that rely on electricity-dependent medical equipment. People, for example, using an oxygen concentrator in their home. And a lot of batteries will die after about 8 hours. So without backup power, people might be unable to continue using those devices. It's also possible that after about 8 hours, the temperature inside people's homes, whether this is a blackout occurring in the winter and the home gets very cold, or the summer and the home gets very hot, that's kind of the time period that we would expect some of those effects to really start taking place. But I would say this is not a sure thing, this 8 hour period, and it may differ depending on kind of the health condition you're worried about, the age group that you're worried about. And so that's an area we're continuing to work in.
And who and where are the most vulnerable people in America when the grid goes down?
A lot of people are vulnerable. I think the first thing that comes to mind, of course, are people relying on medical devices that need power, right? Because if I'm on a ventilator in my home that helps me breathe and the power goes out, I'm immediately, you know, I don't need an 8 hour power outage. I need a 10 minute power outage that things can become very bad for me. So that's the first group that comes to mind. But then of course the populations that we see are often susceptible to environmental exposures. Pregnant people, older adults, children, groups that have more trouble thermoregulating and keeping their temperatures stable are going to be at risk, because we think that a lot of the health risk from power outages for people not on electricity-dependent medical equipment comes through changes in indoor temperatures and inability to maintain a healthy temperature.
Getting back to the new research on wildfire smoke, did you find a difference between gender or race and dementia risk after wildfire exposure?
We did, in this study, find differences by gender and by individual level race and ethnicity. And so overall, we saw for that 1 microgram per meter cubed increase in 3-year average wildfire PM2.5 exposure, this 18% increase in the odds of developing dementia. For some racially minoritized groups, including Asian and Black Kaiser Permanente members, we saw about a 50% increase in the odds of developing dementia for the same level of exposure. We also saw people living in communities with higher levels of poverty were additionally at risk of developing dementia compared to the overall population. And then we also saw stronger effects in people identifying as men compared to women in this study. So for the kind of disadvantaged populations here, we think it's probably due to inability to change behaviors in the face of wildfire smoke exposure. So maybe these folks are less able to stay indoors with the windows closed, less able to afford HEPA air filtration, or may have additional underlying health conditions that already put them at greater risk. The comparison of men to women was interesting to us. And then I was talking to a sociologist at the University of Washington, and she was like, of course, that's what you saw. Because she's out in the field talking to people in communities exposed to smoke, and she said, a lot of the men just don't change their behavior, they just go about their day, whereas the women seem more concerned about this environmental insult. And we've seen that with other environmental exposures, that women are maybe more attuned to them and more willing to change behaviors in the face of environmental threats. So that may be what's going on here, that men aren't taking as many health protective behaviors in the face of wildfire smoke exposure.
Well, you've mentioned staying indoors and running HEPA filters and wearing a mask outside, a good N95 mask. Do you have any other tips for how listeners can protect their brains when wildfire smoke is around?
In the short term, I think those are the main things that we can do. In the midterm, I think trying to talk to policymakers and get better forest management practices in place. We know that kind of a combination of tree thinning and prescribed burning can result in lower levels of wildfire exposure over the course of a year and protect health. In the longer term, we need much stronger climate policy because, as we know, the main driver of increases in wildfire smoke exposure is climate change.
Well, given the serious health impact in this and other studies, do you think the public is getting appropriate air quality warnings, and do they understand the very things that we are talking about? What are the public health steps that we need?
I think right now we're starting to see it, for example, in California, that people, the general public, is understanding the problem. And I say that because we used to see, as the level of smoke exposure went up, bad health outcomes just increased and increased and increased. But now we start to see, actually, at the highest levels of exposure, health is getting a little bit better. And why is that? Because people are changing their behavior. They're staying indoors. So medium high levels of smoke now actually are the worst for health in California, whereas the highest levels, people get the message. But we need to start having behavior change at lower levels. I would say outside California or the West Coast of the United States, people are not implementing these behavior changes as much as of yet. And like I was saying, I mean, I think we need to get used to, in this era of climate change, checking the weather and checking the air quality every morning and taking steps to protect ourselves, because as of yet, we don't have the nationwide or state-level policies in place that are going to protect us.
Joan, what will you be working on next?
Next big step for me is thinking about co-occurring hazards with incident dementia and exacerbation of adverse health outcomes. So we're not just seeing increases in wildfires, right? We're seeing more heat waves. We're seeing more power outages, like we were talking about. And our group wants to understand, what's it mean when all of those things happen together for health? It's going to likely be much worse if a wildfire hits in the midst of a heat wave and then there's no air conditioning because the power's gone out. That seems like it's going to result in much worse health outcomes. But we haven't seen a lot of studies tackling that problem yet, so that's the next big step for us.
From the University of Washington, we've been speaking with epidemiologist Dr. Joan Casey. You can find links to learn more in my show blog at ecoshock.org. I always add some useful notes and links there. Joan, thank you for talking with us.
Thank you.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. That's it for this week. We're out of time. People need real science from the scientists direct. Please tell others about this program. Radio EcoShock is now on Blue Sky. Find us and follow to get a weekly show announcement and spread the word there. Thank you for listening, helping, and caring about our world.